Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master, Paramhansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, humbly we bow to you all. Help us to attune ourselves to your divine presence within, that we may awaken to your unconditional love, to receive you in our hearts and minds, and be your instrument in giving that love to all. Peace. Amen. Let's now meditate for a few minutes. For those of you who've come particularly for the topic, which you may or may not have, our topic today is forgiveness of oneself, of the world, of other people. Let's meditate on what we might be able to receive or to make our hearts and minds receptive to divine inspiration as it may come. And if there are particular questions or aspects of this that you would like to discuss, after we meditate, we'll make a list of those topics. So let's open ourselves to divine inspiration and ask Divine Mother to guide us all. Om, peace, amen. This is a very big and interesting topic, and can be a very personal one. So I'd kind of like to do it first based on anything that you've brought in this morning, and then we'll see where it goes from there. So if anyone has any particular side of this question you'd like to hear discussed, yes, Catherine.
I think that I've come a long way in learning to forgive others.
Uh-huh.
But I still have a lot of trouble forgiving myself.
Yeah, self is the issue, huh? All right. Anyone else? Christina.
I was thinking about a bunch of my friends' long story who I felt at the beginning I needed to forgive because I felt unjustly
whatevered. Yeah.
But a lot of time has passed and I sort of got over it. Now I think I really just don't care anymore. If I saw him, I'd say, how are you? I don't know, is that forgiveness or is that just...
Okay, that's just... Yeah, okay, self versus others. And time. I think time is a very interesting factor. I myself don't have any really good answers, but I'm going to shut this, just at least close it a little. Yeah, time is a very interesting factor. I often wonder, do we actually get over things or do we just outlast them? There's a lot that's very interesting on that point. And I worry is the right word. I'm concerned about it because there is reincarnation. And if you've just gotten too tired and are not really, don't have the energy to be annoyed anymore, when your energy is all fresh again, will you just start? And I will explore that, but I don't have a solid answer to that one, but I do think about it. Yeah, it's a very important question.
I was thinking about things I needed to forgive myself for.
Mm-hmm.
And when I dig deep enough, you know, I can see the part I've played in what's happening in mm-hmm. the world.
Right.
And how to forgive myself for that, or even to recognize it. But because that's the first thing, is to recognize it and then to forgive myself.
Okay, just awareness. That's what you're saying. You know, increasing awareness, diminished awareness, what part does it play? Are we culpable if we don't remember? I have a story on that, but I'll offer it later. Any other comments or questions? Yes, Joy?
Yes, on the path, I have made a sincere effort to forgive resentments that I've held on to, and I find that forgiveness seems to come in degrees.
Right, right. I'll write down all or nothing. Okay. Yeah, time, all or nothing, yeah, very good. There's a, when we did the theatrical production of Swamiji's allegory, The Land of Golden Sunshine, I was one of the narrators. Ramamurti and I were the narrators. It's online if you ever want to see it. It's a beautiful production. It's this long poetic allegory. And Swamiji, at one point, It's a poem that Swami Kriyananda wrote, and I had to recite lines that had to do with these dimly perceived realities that had been made vague, not by lack of intensity, but by just the layers of time coming over them. And every time I would read that dimly perceived, you know, behind the layers, then I would ask myself this question: how much is actual freedom and how much is just we've become distracted by other things? So, yeah, it's a very good question. Yes, Sneha?
When something happens to you and you feel that it was wrongly, in some way someone has wronged you, how much of it is accountability in the sense that you hold a person accountable for it, you forgive them, but so the play between forgiving and not letting that happen to you again with that person, that relationship between forgiveness and accountability and acceptance?
Let's see. It would be self-respect, almost, is what you're talking about. You have to have enough self-respect that forgiveness isn't just a lack of self-worth. So I would say self-worth, self-respect. Is that fair?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you're asking how does it express, but that's really the question, is, you know, what is self-respect? What is selfish? How does that all balance out? Oh, those are good questions. Anything else? Yeah. Stages. Well, this is the all or nothing question. But stages, and the actual word is, Swami has a word of directional. Directional, I'll say values, that we tend to think in absolute terms. We tend to think all or nothing. But in fact, it's directional, because nature never makes sudden leaps. You don't generally, I mean, sometimes you have a mystical experience that just completely changes your awareness, but as a rule, it's not one way today and another way tomorrow. It's one way today and another way 15 years from now, as a rule. This is all about time. Okay, any other questions? Yes, Vajina?
Say someone hurts you,
mm-hmm.
and you feel hurt, that the person changes.
Ah.
And then you think they do, but you're mature. And then you feel love again.
Mm-hmm.
You never stop feeling love for that person. And so is that, I think that's how it should be, because love is more important than anything. But?
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to write down, you know, love, trust, and then I'll add the word truth. Yeah, how does it all play together? The difference between affirmation, positive thinking, and realistic appraisal of what you're dealing with.
It's one of those, yeah. Maybe it goes with the self-respect, but so someone does you wrong, and you're both wrong,
yeah.
But you forgive, want to move on, and
yeah.
Well, they seem to be oblivious to their part of it. I think it's all you. And so you want to heal, but you're still thinking, well, shouldn't they apologize? Shouldn't they see they're part of it? Am I just, you know, the doormat because I'm willing to take the whole, you know?
Right. Let's see. I would call it the role of others, you know. You know, how much of your, it does relate to this, but how much of your capacity to transcend is dependent on my brother put up a little sign on his cabinet that said, except for one rather insignificant exception, the entire world is composed of others. Which was a reminder to him that, you know, his reality is not the only reality. That's very complicated, but the role of others is a big deal because there appear to be a lot of them, and most of them are pretty much out of your control. It's exceedingly annoying. They all have this sense of identity with themselves. Master had the beautiful phrase, spirit is center everywhere, and the other corollary to that is circumference nowhere, but that phrase center everywhere is extremely important for all of understanding of life, because everyone's universe emanates from, as he put it, I think in the poem Samadhi, is it? No, not in Samadhi, but in a different poem. In the poem, in the chapter in the autobiography, when he had an experience in cosmic consciousness, in Autobiography of a Yogi, he said, the word was empyrean, I think, which I think means this big, the center of the empyrean was a point of intuitive perception in my own heart. And so that the entire universe it emanates from a point of intuitive perception centered in oneself. And the most fascinating thing to me is that everybody stands at the center of their own universe. And their own universe makes enormous sense to them because they're looking at it from this perspective. You know, we look here down on the playground and it looks a certain way. If you're in the playground looking up, it looks a certain way. If you're in the playground looking across at the jungle gym there, we would both see the jungle gym, but we would see it from a completely different perspective. So who is seeing it correctly? It would just depend on where you're standing. This comes to the question of love, trust, and truth. But I've contemplated that fact so many times, that everybody makes sense to themselves. You know, I've done, over the years, especially earlier, I just did so much counseling, an enormous amount of counseling, and talked to people just all the time. And, you know, for a while I tried to impose upon them my perception, just because I thought that was helpful. You know, sometimes it seemed like a good idea at the time. But gradually I realized how powerfully real everybody's perception is, no matter what it looks like from the other side. And so center everywhere has to be the role of others. Okay, anything else? I'm not in a hurry. I just wanted to get everything up here so I don't miss it.
If on some level you've had a...
Pardon me?
If at some point you've had a healing, kind of dealt with it, but as you progress, there's a deeper kind of connecting. Maybe in the beginning it was more mentally, but you can forgive on a mental level, intellectually. Then you get in touch with the feeling that's connected to that. Just to talk about that. Maybe.
Well, levels of stages, direction. You know, Swami Kriyananda himself said, in this book I've just finished, it's in context in the 700 pages of this book, but anyway, it's in there. He says he was talking specifically about what was the major traumatic experience of his life, which was having his own Guru Bhais turn against him, being expelled from Self-Realization Fellowship back in 1962, was in itself traumatic, but the real trauma of it was the unrelenting opposition of his Guru Bhais for the rest of his life. So, and he went through multiple stages of transcending it, and he said a couple of different things. One is people just say, well, just rise above it. He said, that's very easy to say. but it's really not so easy to do. And then he said, because he had multiple experiences of, well, for example, in 19, when it would have been the early 90s, he, in the course of litigation, he read all these internal documents and was, as he put it, really startled to see the depth of his Guru Bhai's antipathy toward him. He had just never allowed himself to perceive it. And the day after he reviewed these documents, he collapsed and was, and his blood pressure just went, they couldn't get a reading on his blood pressure. He was in Florence, Italy. And like for 3 hours, he said the doctors just labored over him trying to save his life, which they did, or his life was saved. Now he said, but while he was there, knowing he was so close to death, he said he didn't feel anything but love. Just nothing but love. It was just, he was so, he felt so free. But he said, when you reach a certain height or depth, as you want to put it, of transcendence, all it does is reveal what is beyond that. So you may think that you've finished, but you may have only reached a certain level where you get to find out what more is there. If you think of it in a vertical sense, if there's a big hill in front of you and you climb to the top, among other things, it gives you a view of what's been hidden by that hill. And so you may have, in fact, climbed a very steep mountain and reached a very notable peak, but you will also then be able to see valleys you didn't know were there, and you will be able to see mountains that were higher than the one you were standing at because you were your whole vision was blocked. So we have to understand that that is not failure. That is actually what progress looks like. And part of the difficulty, and I'll start, unless I have more comments, because that's a good one. We have to understand what progress looks like and even what success is. We have these very absolutist ideas in our minds, and one of the ways we torture ourselves is that we set up false standards. And then when we continually fail to meet them, we actually think we failed. You know, it's as if I was going to say, unless I can grow, you know, a green hand out of my elbow, I haven't really succeeded. And then every morning I look and the green hand isn't there, so I get to be a complete failure every single day. And it's not because I failed, it's but because I've set myself something that no one could accomplish, that can't be accomplished. But part of the syndrome that we're working with is the subconscious necessity to always fail, which we then support with the whole system. I know this gets a little cerebral, but when we can really begin to see it in a more realistic way, it changes the whole paradigm, really. There's a decades ago in the magazine that was, I don't even know if it still exists, it was called Psychology Today. And there was an article, which I kept. I might have only just thrown it away. I kept it for 40 years. It was called Perfectionist Script for Self-Defeat. And that was when it described the commitment to make sure that you never measure up by always writing a script that no one could meet, and then you get to never meet it. And and it gives you the illusion that you're really trying hard. But in fact, what you're doing is you're trying to guarantee that a deeper subconscious commitment that is really about a lack of self-worth is always maintained. And it penetrated. It was my MO, as they say at that time. And so I like, whoa, did I ever understand that one? That's why I kept the article for so long. Okay, any more comments or questions? These are all very helpful. Bethany?
In terms of resentment, I know that, you know, what role does forgiveness play in terms of resentment? Because I know resentment, like you said, it's like perception, it's your own perception, and so the resentment, if it's yours, it sort of belongs to you, like whatever expectations you had or weren't met. So does forgiveness even play a role in resentment?
Oh, resentment is big. The thing about resentment, the trick that God plays on us is often people have really done us wrong. Often they've really behaved badly, and I am right. You know, I am absolutely justified in feeling that you are a terrible twerp and you should never have done that to me. and you're not apologizing, and I have every right to feel the way I do. That's like a more subtle level. You know, other times you can have just misread it or been exaggerated in your expectation. Other times people are really terrible. Many people on the planet are really terrible. They're either terrible because they're evil, or they're terrible because they're ignorant. There's, you know, what doesn't matter. The fact that you're right just reinforces self-justification, but it doesn't necessarily lead to freedom. It's the same question, the role of others in it, but I will write the word resentment, because resentment is a really big word. I put it to myself, somebody owes me an apology. It sort of has become a kind of cosmic phrase in my own mind. Somebody owes me an apology. I'll explain in a moment, but I got it down to that in one very meaningful moment in my life when I realized that. I'll bring that story and we'll just start in the middle. I was in seclusion at the meditation retreat, which is only matters because it's the picture I have in my mind. I was staying in the dome that Swami Kriyananda lived in, that's still up there. I was in seclusion for a week or two. I don't do well with short seclusions because I'm so mentally active. In 2 or 3 days, I have just barely begun to calm down, so it doesn't help me. I would have to stay at least 10 days in order to, as I put it, get rid of Asha so I could begin to go into seclusion. So it was probably a fairly long seclusion that way. And I was meditating as much as I was able. And we often think in meditation of offering ourselves. That's often how it is. I offer myself to God. I lay myself at the feet of the Guru. I give myself to Divine Mother. Any way that you want to sort of think about that. Door of my heart, open wide, you know. And I was sitting there in meditation, and it occurred to me that perhaps it would be interesting not merely to give love, but also try to receive. To allow Divine Mother to come into me is how I was thinking about it. And I became aware when I tried to do this. This must have been somewhere in the 80s. Could have even been in the 70s, but I think it was in the 80s. And I became aware because I was sensitized by having been in seclusion, which in my normal life, because I'm so mentally active, I wouldn't necessarily have noticed. But I could literally feel. I could feel that Swamiji has described the Guru's presence, and God's presence is like a lighthouse. And if you think of a rocky point and a lighthouse, I don't even know if they use lighthouses anymore, but anyway, there's a lighthouse. There's a huge beam of light, and it's often on the rocky shore of a seacoast where ships are coming in from a distance and they don't want to crash against the rocks. It's so interesting now because the world has changed so much that images that are very vivid for one group of people are completely unknown to others. I'm going to diverge here. There was a man who wrote a book about writing, somebody McPhee, and he talked about if you're going to write for modern publications, you need to know that references you're going to make are going to be completely incomprehensible. He teaches at Princeton, and he made a huge list of references that were completely clear to him and had his students comment, and like 80% of them meant nothing to the generation that it was very interesting. So anyway, here's the lighthouse, whether they even exist. But that light just beams out. Fog, wind, rain, nothing affects it. It just completely beams out. The perception of it is based on external conditions and even whether anybody is even looking. But the lighthouse, the light beams no matter what. So it's an image, or you can also think of it, and again, these are images that don't work anymore, but there used to be such a thing as a radio transmission. And it just was a transmitter, and the waves went out, and you had a radio, and you received it, or you didn't. But how you received it, I mean, it depended to a sense on the transmission, but there's a powerful transmission, and you either receive it or you don't, depending on your radio. But the transmission is unaffected by the quality of your radio. So I was meditating, and both of these images were clear in my consciousness, and I became aware of the fact that the force was coming toward me enormously. But just before it reached me, it hit this wall, my internal wall. And I felt it in my heart. And the wall was pretty thick and pretty solid. And I could feel it was not just this incarnation, but all of the incarnations I'd had before, where I'd been disappointed, where I had become angry, where people had done things to me, where they never apologized, never made it right. And I could just look at the incarnation I was living. I've had a, thank you God, a life with very little disappointment in it. You know, it's been a very light vibration in that sense. I don't have, as some people have to deal with, you know, a long list of traumatic, real, genuine traumatic events. So I didn't have anything I could point to in this life. But many years ago, when I first came onto the path, and I was talking to Swami Kriyananda about this, I told him that I have had, since my earliest childhood memories, I've had this compelling need to find a way to avoid suffering and to have true happiness. And I said to him, it always puzzled me, because my life was pretty good. But even in the midst of no apparent suffering, I had this desperate need to find a way to avoid suffering, to transcend it, not merely to protect myself from it, but to genuinely stand above it. And I said to him, you know, why? Well, he said, the most obvious, he said, past lives. Of course, past lives. And when you look around the world, if whether or not you've had those experiences yourself, look how many difficult things happen to people. You know, just unexpected death, financial catastrophe, illness, betrayal, disappointment, war. There was a woman, she was from Croatia or one of that part of the world. I don't have a clear sense of exactly there. She was visiting here, actually, and I was just chatting with her. She was here. She was talking about moving to Ananda Assisi, but was presenting to me, and I didn't know her at all. She was presenting to me what people often do. Well, there are certain obstacles, you know. So I, in order to be helpful, just started asking her in a almost casual way, well, what's preventing you? So I asked her the question. I said, well, do you have any family, you know, back where you are? And she just said to me, no, they were all killed in the war. Just like, oh my God, you know, you just never know what's behind a person's face. No, I have no family at all left. They were all killed. Oh, geez. You know, it makes you think, whoa, whatever is bothering me is not much, is it? And this was all just like, you know, within the last 5 years that it happened. It wasn't like something that was very old. I just had to exhale and tell her, well, I see how complicated that is. So whether or not we remember the details, you can depend on the fact that you either remember it from this life or it left what's called a samskar. Samskar is an incredibly important word. There's no English translation for samskar. So you have to use that word. Samskar means vibrational impressions left on your consciousness from experiences in past lives. So we're all born with certain samskars, and we're just inclined in certain ways. And that's what makes our center of the imperium, the intuitive perception in our heart, so unusual, unique, is because we pick that position because of the samskars. So somebody can say, oh, why are you taking it so hard? Why are you so worried about that? That's really nothing to be concerned about. But they don't have necessarily the same samskars that you have. So whereas something that happens to one person may just make a light impression, on another person what happens, I call it a geologic strata. It opens you, and think of them as vertical strata or however you want to think about it, or horizontal. When I've never been to the Grand Canyon, but I've seen the pictures where you can go down into the Grand Canyon and you see all these different geologic strata where different things happen, archaeological digs, you go down in time. So something where there's a samskara that causes you to be open, a very small bit of energy can come in, but it will drop all the way down into what may be a huge vein of samskaras, and therefore what we are experiencing is catalyzed by the present, but what we are experiencing is not the present. Now, that's an important fact because it helps us discern fact from projection, but it's also an important fact because that means that what we are experiencing is real. Because the feelings we are having are real feelings. They just are not necessarily related to the circumstances that we're trying to say cause them. So back when I'm here in my meditation and I'm conscious of this wall, and I could just feel that that wall was every unresolved anger, every resentment that I carried, every time other people disappointed me, every time circumstances did something to me that caused me to suffer, I had a real simple solution, which is I'll just wall it off a little bit. I remember many years ago, I was living, as it happened, at the seclusion retreat, and we had these wooden tables that were in the dining room, and somebody had the idea that we would put this clear polyurethane paint. I don't know what that means, plastic or something. But we'd paint the wooden tables with this coating. They would still look like wooden tables, but they would be much easier to wash and the wood would be protected. And I remember, because this must have been all the same cycle, I was thinking that's what I do. That's what everyone does, but that's certainly what I do. It's a little tough having to feel all this, so I'll just paint it over. And I'll still look the same. But things won't penetrate quite so much. But the trouble is, when we start doing that, it keeps our energy from coming out, and it keeps energy from coming in. And it may protect us from too much pain, but it also inhibits our capacity to receive in every respect. The entire spiritual path to all those who received him. To them gave he the power to become the sons of God. So I'm sitting here in meditation with this very sincere desire to receive this energy, and I realized that I myself had set a limit on my relationship with God. And that limit was this vortex of self-protective energy that I was constantly maintaining subconsciously and sometimes consciously, but I was constantly maintaining it. It's called a vritti. It's a vortex of energy in the spine that spins at a certain vibration, and that vibration, well, it can be at any level, but mine was at a very self-protective vibration. And so when I wanted my energy to flow upward and express through the spiritual eye, it couldn't, because it was, as it headed upward, instead of going upward, it got sucked off into this whirlpool, just like the water in a river. So there would be some energy left to go up, but much of it had to keep going in this circle. And as I started, I've always known that what inhibits your meditation is often the point of your meditation. Because what comes to you in that moment is often what's been trying to communicate with you for a long time, but because we were too distracted, we didn't know it. So there is just restless chatter. But sometimes what's interrupting your meditation is the point. You're increasing your awareness, and therefore you're perceiving a reality you didn't know. So I was a little shocked. I was more than a little shocked. Because up until that point, I had never allowed myself to realize the degree to which I was being run by this deeply self-protective shield that was keeping me from getting out and was keeping other energy from coming in. And I started thinking about it. And everybody's different. Part of it was just, you know, brokenheartedness. We get our hearts broken pretty steadily in life. It's this world is meant to inspire us to seek a higher level. And we are very convinced, Maya has convinced us, that this life is meant to comfort and please us. And we hold that thought against all evidence because the implications of it are too frightening. And that's why out of 1,000, only one seeks God, and out of 1,000 who seek God, only one really succeeds, because the implications of that are too frightening. Now, eventually they're not, but that's the battle on the spiritual path, is to realize this is a divine promise, not a threat. So we persist in thinking, you know, there's something wrong because this world is not pleasing and comforting me. Somebody did something to me. You know, I screwed up. We just keep hammering that point, not realizing that, no, actually, this is just the way it works. And the point is to go to a higher level of awareness. But I'll come back to that in a moment. But anyway, when I was sitting there like that, I realized that a lot of my upset was that people had done me wrong. You know, that I was really carrying on a lot of thoughts that people had failed me in a lot of different ways. And it really came down to, and this is where I started all this, it really came down to somebody owes me an apology. I mean, on a really big, like, generic level, I realized I was walking around with this thought that somebody owes me an apology. And then I could list out a number of people that I knew in this life who I thought owed me apologies, who I'm still waiting, you know, to receive. But it was impressive to me. And I this was decades ago, and I still work with it. You know, it's like, first of all, what would be accomplished if they apologized? That's just an interesting question. You know, what would it do for me? Then I would get to say, you see, I was right. You see, I was right. Now, is that like a liberating thought? Because then I get to be right. You really did hurt me, but it doesn't transcend. It does ease a certain stress. I mean, apologies are nice. I offer them very readily myself because I certainly don't want anyone to die thinking I owe them, just for their sakes and also for my own if I'm wrong. Okay. Comments, thoughts, questions about that before we go on to something else? The obvious question is what to do about it, but we'll go there in just a minute.
Or how to get to it, to recognize what it is for you personally that yeah. is building the wall.
Right.
I think everybody has it.
Yeah. You know, the question is what's to get to what is affecting you personally, which is, of course, tricky. There's a twofold reality, and both of them are true. I certainly benefit from knowledge. Recently, a friend of mine, I have a lot of Gemini in my horoscope, and recently a friend of mine quoted, I think she was quoting Swamiji, and I just learned this yesterday. I said, why didn't I hear that like 40 years ago? I must have read it, but I didn't get it. She said, Gemini's, the intuition of a Gemini often comes as calm, clear, mental understanding. And that was like, oh yeah, that's, because I've often said, quote, I don't have the kind of intuitive experiences that a lot of people do, but I've always had calm, clear mental understanding that pops into my head. And there's a certain, and I mean, and I trust it when it happens, and I've always trusted it. You trust it like intuition, but I never quite idiotically got the words together until yesterday. But let me just find this. So it definitely, I think, helps, and it helps most people, when you have some kind of a calm, clear mental perception of, oh, I'm holding on to this. Oh, that's what I was really thinking. Because what happens is, you see, our whole life is compelled by realities that we are not aware of. And so we get into these crazy positions where we're deeply and fiercely defending a position that we're trying to relate to something that just happened, when in fact we're simply being compelled by the geological strata into which this has dropped. Master went so far as to say, because things on this plane of consciousness appear to happen sequentially, we succumb to the delusion that one thing causes another. I mean, that is the craziest phrase, and I've enjoyed just thinking about it. But he doesn't explain it further. It's just like an intuitive perception he drops in there. But we have the idea that one thing causes another. You say that to me, I react. I say something to you, you react. And we're both now really upset, and we think that one thing has caused another. And we don't understand that this geological strata has just been activated, and all you did was activate it. You didn't create it. And then I fiercely defend myself and activate your geologic strata, and pretty soon we think we're having a rational experience, but we're not at all, because nothing that has happened has been caused by what appeared to happen. This is why so many relationships are so rocky, because we're just trying to make things happen and draw parallels that are just not there. The feelings are true, but the cause and effect is different, and that's what we all have to learn to begin to work with. Yes, Catherine.
How do you deal with that?
There you have it. I'm not going to just say, I don't know, 5 cents, please. You know? I had somebody speaking to me recently, and they brought to me two very, very complicated personal situations that were just absolutely beyond me. And my answer was, I have no idea. You know, this is so complicated, there's nothing much I can say. But what I really had to say, I'm going to start here and then I'll be more helpful. Okay, there is no shortcut. And a tremendous reason why we suffer so much is because we have bought into the fundamental delusion that life should be easier than it is. I had this conversation, it wasn't a conversation actually, it was a monologue on my part and an attentive listening by Swami Kriyananda. But I had this one issue that I was really struggling with. Everything else in my life was fine, and I had this one thing I had to deal with. So I was sitting there, and I was very emotionally upset, and I had just come to him with this, like, it was very similar to what I had to deal with recently myself, where somebody just brought me this very complicated situation, and there was nothing I could do. So I brought Swami this complicated situation and wanted him to, not exactly to solve it, but to tell me that there was some easier way out that I hadn't noticed. Essentially what I ended up saying to him, I didn't use these words, but it was real close to it, if life weren't so hard, it would be easier. And he had absolutely no response to that. There was just simply nothing to say. And he was usually with me, he was very animated and very responsive, and we had a very easy exchange of energy. He was sitting, and he had absolutely no expression on his face. That's the only way I can describe it. It was like there was no way to respond to what I just said, so he didn't. He just sort of stared at me and let what I'd said just kind of sit in the room between us so I could look at it. If life weren't so hard, it would be easier. So, like, what is he supposed to do about that? You know? Because what I wanted from him, and I have to say it in real simple words, I wanted him to rescue me. And that is another incredible concept that we have to come to. When I was living, I've lived in Palo Alto since 1987, January 1987. For 16 years prior to that, I lived at Ananda Village, which was and is still heaven on earth in many ways. But it wasn't my destiny to live there. I needed to come to an urban area. I had to do all the work. I've been here more than 30 years now, so this is really my life. But for a while, just to give you the context, at that historical point in Ananda's history, Ananda was that single rural community. We didn't even say Ananda Village, Ananda Palo Alto. We just said Ananda because there was only one. And if you were sent out, was the phrase that was used, you basically lived somewhere else for a year, maybe a year and a half, and then you got to come home. And it was only at the time that I moved and Anant and Maria and a few other people moved away from the village, that the idea that we were going to establish actual other Anandas, it was the beginning of that thought form. So I too had the thought that I would be sent away and then after a little while I would get to come home. And mostly I didn't behave that way. I knew that was not going to work. So I made a total commitment to this. I burned all my bridges. I left not one shred of my belongings anywhere else. Everything was here. But way back in the back of my mind, I thought this was temporary. And somewhere in the 90s, I don't remember exactly where, it in an exchange with Swami, it became clear that I was never going anywhere. That I was going, I might as well just decide where my ashes would be distributed because I was going to die here. Not soon, but that caused me to realize how much of me was still waiting to be rescued. Just waiting to be rescued. I was not really going to have to put out the energy. And when that happened, I had to make a long list of the things that I was not dealing with because I was going to be rescued. I mean, including at that time I was gardening a lot, including the little corner of the garden where nothing would grow, including certain people that I just couldn't figure out how to get along with and I would never have to because I would be rescued. Just a long list. There's a man who used to do, he was one of the first people to do a lot of work with conscious dying, Stephen Levine. He's probably really old school now, but for me he was a revolution when Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and others was the first people to really bring in the idea of conscious dying. It was now a long time ago, but it was a revolution. And he used to run seminars for people who had terminal illnesses. And when you would first come in, weekend seminars, I never attended, but I read all about it. He would have you make two lists. And one list was the list of everything that you were going to miss out on because you were going to die before you had hoped to die. And those were long, tearful, extremely emotional. I'll never hold my grandchild. I'll never walk my daughter down the aisle. I'll never really go to France, whatever it might be. It would be big, cathartic scenes. Everyone would make those lists. And after that was done, then you would make the list of everything you got to avoid because you were going to die, like this. I'll never have to care for my demented father, whatever it might be. But then, oddly, that was the list everybody had to work with. Because that's a far more motivating list than just disappointment. It's the waiting to be rescued list. And so recently I had this experience where all I could say was, there is no simple answer. This is very complicated karma. I mean, I didn't express all this, but this is what I would say. And this is how I put it to myself. And this is how I put it to myself when I was meditating there. I realized I've spent lifetimes building up this delusion. And every step of the way, it was what I thought would bring me happiness and ease my suffering. When Master came to America, just before he came to America in 1920, he wrote a book. It was actually ghostwritten by one of his disciples. And the book was called The Science of Religion, that's what it was called. Swami Kriyananda rewrote the book as God is for everyone. But it was the premise of Master's whole teaching in America, and it was very simple. Everybody has two motivations in life, to avoid suffering, to experience happiness. And everything that we do, absolutely everything, is based on those two premises. And every action we take, it makes sense to us from our perspective, where we're standing. We think this will decrease our suffering and increase our happiness, including murder. I'm involved, you've run away with my wife. I'm going to go and shoot you. Because clearly if you weren't there, my wife wouldn't have left me. So I'll shoot you and that'll solve the problem. And maybe I'll shoot her too. But when a person does that, he sees that's the cause of my suffering. If I get rid of that, it will ease my suffering. And every small thing, I'm not going to talk to you about it. I'm going to scream. I'm going to drive you out of my life. I'm going to go underground and just be furious and wait for you to apologize to me. I'm going to just drink myself into a stupor and die young. That's all what we're doing. And what Master says in Science of Religion, and Swami says in God is for Everyone, is that the only thing that works is to draw closer to God, to expand your awareness, and see your relation, see everything in relation to a greater reality. Because the only thing that will ever really alleviate suffering and bring you happiness is truth. Which is, and the truth may be that you are such a scum, and you are so impossible, and you are so unhealthy to me, that I'm going to drive you out of my life and never speak to you again. Because that may be the truth of the situation and the healthiest, best thing that you can do. Truth is not being nice. Truth is being appropriate for the circumstances in which you find yourself. And doing that which will actually lead to what you want, a decrease of suffering and increase of happiness. So there's no dogma. You can't set up a dogma because it depends on where you're standing and what is forward for you. You know, and this is where all these love, trust, truth, fact. I didn't put fact versus truth. Now let's see, coming back to suffering. And I'll pause for a moment. Okay, comments, thoughts, questions? Joy?
The idea of truth is not being nice. Me to the thought that I was having about discrimination in the way the Master said you should be open-minded but not so open-minded that your brains fall out.
Mm-hmm.
Which comes to the idea of forgiving someone but the discrimination of not forgetting. I mean, is that eventually transcended? Because if you really feel like you're on the path to forgiving and you have forgiven someone, I mean, isn't it discrimination to be wise enough to remember this person's vibration and not want to get entangled in that again?
Okay, I'm going to repeat the question for the sake of the recording. The question is, even if you forgive someone, don't you need to remember what you're dealing with? Otherwise, things will get quite confusing. And this is also based on what I just said about truth is not necessarily just to be nice. Okay, I'm a little torn between wanting to erase what's on the board and write something else, but let me think about it like this. Let's take this really from the core, because this is a core part of what we're talking about. Okay. There was a woman who was part of Ananda for a while and then repudiated what we were doing and went and started really campaigning against Swami Kriyananda. But he felt a deep spiritual commitment to the person. And I asked him at one point, I said, you know, if she really wanted to come back, would you take her back? He said, if she was sincere, he said, I would. But I would treat her differently now that I know what she is capable of doing. Which was just a very simple way to put it. It wasn't that he wouldn't provide opportunities for her, but he would provide opportunities with the understanding that treachery was part of her nature. And therefore it would be foolish to just act as if she was not inclined toward treachery because she clearly demonstrated it. But nor, if she were sincere, would he keep her away. Now I was in a situation of, there was this one man who was extremely, he had lived at Ananda for a long time, and then when Ananda was engaged in all that litigation with Self-Realization Fellowship attacking us, he became an expert on Ananda. He was really close to the whole SRF situation. The lawyers consulted him because he was the one who knew. And he also campaigned against us, you know, through letters and things like that. He was a terrible person, behaved in a terrible manner. And so then, how long would it have been later? No, it was actually sort of, yeah, the litigation wasn't over, but it was like 10 years or so into it. That's what it was. And somebody came and brought the man to me because now was the time to heal. Right. So I didn't think any of this out. It was in a public situation. They brought the man to me and you know, with this big, you know, well, we're all big enough now to get over this. So my first response, and I didn't have anything personal against him. In fact, he'd been a friend. And I said, do you repudiate what you did? And then with very careful, I'm a wordsmith, so it's hard to trick me with words. Very carefully, actually it was his wife who said it. We're very sorry that people will be were hurt. I said, yeah, that's not really the same. I said, do you repudiate what you did? Do you want to try to make amends? No, not at all. I said, well, it would not only be inappropriate, it would be stupid of me to act as if we're friends. You have to repudiate your wrong action. Otherwise, no, thank you, I'm not interested. You know, then later it came down that, well, Asha's, quote, been on the front line so long, you know, she just... And when I heard that someone said that, I went to them and I said, absolutely not. It was just not right. You know, this person behaved very badly. And if they're completely still willing to defend that, why on earth would I invite them in? I said it would just set us all up to be cut to pieces again. And later I wrote to Swamiji about it. He said, good girl. And it wasn't nice. And it was actually a scene in front of other people. And a number of other people were quite uncomfortable and considered that I wasn't being spiritual. I didn't think any of those things were true. I think I was behaving exactly... I mean, I loved the man, and I still do. I didn't have, one of the reasons I could do that, I didn't have any malice toward him. You know, he just, his karma, it's his problem, really. He caused me personally and us an enormous amount of trouble, but God knows God can take care of it. You know, it's like, there's nothing, I don't need to be the avenging Lord. You know, the karma will catch up, and it'll just be his issue. And I mean, I do love him. I've always loved him. But I don't trust him at all because he's absolutely untrustworthy. And the truth of it is, you know, absolutely, you're not to be anywhere near me. So discrimination is fundamental. Otherwise, what you're doing, and we have to think about this, and this gets very complicated, we're living in wishful thinking. Oh, I so want everything to be nice again. I'll just forgive you, and then everything will be nice again. And that was partly what others were trying to impose on me by bringing this man. They were very uncomfortable with disharmony. And they were not being motivated by truth. They were being motivated by the fact that they wanted disharmony to end. They were afraid of disharmony. And see, that's what happens to us a lot. We are not being motivated even by generosity. We are just afraid and uncomfortable, and we're trying to ease our own suffering. And one of the ways to ease our own suffering is, I'll just forgive you, and then we'll just all be nice, and we'll just all be friends, and then it'll all be over, and you won't really be as selfish and as awful as I thought you were. And then the problem is, you can open the scripture and find lots of places where that sounds like a good idea. And that's where your word discrimination is absolutely the right word. You have to be able to tell the difference between courage, truth, and wishful thinking. When Ananda was engaged in litigation, which was a huge rite of passage for those of us who had to live through it, among the many things, and this is buried in the 700 pages of my book, among the things is that Swami said, you know, God wants us to be warriors for the light. He wants us to go beyond the self-definition of many devotees at Ananda of being nice people. Because we think, well, the spiritual path is harmony and it's peace, and why would we, you know, be engaged? I mean, we didn't initiate, but we had to defend ourselves. But it wasn't pretty, and it required a tremendous amount of not being nice. Just because sometimes you have to be a warrior. And this is where self-worth and self-respect come in. And what you need to be working with is, I'll say this quickly and then we'll take a break. You are not more important in the eyes of God than anyone else. When Swamiji was, I tend in these matters to often come back to what Swami had to go through with SRF, but when he was so burdened by everything that was happening to him that he literally ran away to Hawaii by himself, and he wasn't sure he would ever come back. It was just too much. And he prayed desperately and deeply to God and Guru. And his question was, why are you allowing? He said, all the work I've ever done, I've done for you, for God and Guru. If you want to take it away from me, I'm not attached. And he wasn't. He said, but why are you allowing such undharmic people to have power over me? Because it was a very, in many ways, an undharmic fight. It's all in my 700-page book. But anyway, having said that, and then he said, Babaji said to him, they are all my children. Wow. And he had to really stand back and realize that this evil person, you know, being allowed to be evil was his necessary progression towards liberation. Just as way back in our past, we were also evil as a necessary, you know, we did murder because it seemed like a good idea at the time and we had to figure it out. They're all my children. We are not more important. Just because it's me doesn't make me more important than any of those others. But here's the key. You are also not less important. And this is where people get confused. You know, we are all equal. We are all God's children. And it's not spiritual to think of yourself as less valuable. And a lot of people get very confused and think that humility or ego transcendence means that I have no worth. I have no self-respect. And so truth is just to see the whole situation for what it is. Everybody's here to learn their lessons. What is the appropriate response? And that word appropriate is where we'll start after the break. What is the appropriate response to any situation? More than nice, more than not nice. It's just what's appropriate here. And what maybe, and I'll just give this thought before we take the break, what may be appropriate is it is time for me to stand up and assert myself. And I've just had it with your selfish demands. It's my turn. That may be appropriate because maybe what you need to work with is you need to stop being so nice. Maybe being nice for you is a cover for being afraid. There's lots of different questions. All right, let's take a break. Downstairs is hot water and tea. There's a bathroom behind the curtain, several downstairs. The rule of breaks is re-energize yourself, refresh yourself, but don't start anything new. Don't start any new conversations. Don't get involved. Just take a little pause and then come back. Yes, Bhajana?
I was thinking that maybe the answer, not one answer, but maybe for me, is empathy.
Empathy. That's a very good point. Yeah, when empathy is actually empathy and compassion and love, the fact that that man who was so treacherous to Ananda that I don't have any personal feeling toward him at all is because he thinks he's doing a good thing. It's because I can feel his reality. From his point of view, it makes sense to him.
Maybe that's what Swami felt when he was sick and then he had all that love in his heart.
Because he understood that they're sincere and they're doing their best. People forgive the murderers of their own children. You know, there's incredible stories because they begin to see it from that person's point of view.
I would like to have empathy and not be dumb, you know, unconscious.
Yeah.
I haven't learned that one.
No, it's, you know, everybody's worst quality. I think this is universally true. Most people's worst quality is their best quality taken just an inch too far. So it isn't really that we have to repudiate that. We just have to pull it back. It's like we cross the midpoint. So we're talking about empathy. Mm-hmm. So one can be so empathetic that one loses a sense of self-respect, mm-hmm. and is always just seeing it so much from the other person's point of view that they think that that person is more important than me. Mm-hmm. So this is where I came back to saying we're all God's children. Mm-hmm. That it's not good for them if it's bad for you, because it's not truth then. To for you to sacrifice yourself inappropriately for someone else will not help them and it will not help you because it's not the truth. I'm going to take these words off because we've pretty much, well, actually, I haven't hit all of them, so we're going to have to remember time and stages, but we will, because I need to just put a couple of words up here. There's a word which many of you have heard, which is dharma. And dharma means action that leads to greater awareness. I mean, there's lots of definitions of it, but greater awareness is another way of saying, like, to higher consciousness or to self-realization. But if you think about self-realization and higher consciousness, it's all a question about of becoming more aware of a greater reality to the point of infinity. If we think about any progressive experience of our lives, it's always because we became more aware of a greater reality, isn't it? When someone marries an alcoholic and pretends they're not really an alcoholic and they gradually become aware that this person has a drinking problem, you've just become aware. It wasn't like it was created, you just saw it. When we suddenly become aware that with one insignificant exception, this world is composed entirely of others, it always was, we just became more aware of it. If I think of myself as alone and lost and small and isolated, and I gradually realize that I'm a child of God and God is always with me, it wasn't created, I just became more aware of it. So dharma is that action which leads to greater awareness. So, for example, if a person has a terrible fear of disharmony and allows themselves to endure an abusive relationship and completely wrong, I mean, these are very, these are the ways people think these days. Abusive relationship is the common phrase that people use. To my mind, way overused, but nonetheless, it's a fact. I'm not going to dispute it. Someone allows themselves to be mistreated for a long period of time, that's not dharma to sacrifice yourself for that person. It's not dharma because it's not an action that leads to greater awareness. Because why do I have so little self-worth? And why do I think that allowing this person not to get the consequences of their wrong behavior is going to lead to greater awareness? So dharma is simply that action which leads to greater awareness for everyone concerned. And it may not be that the person you repudiate will immediately have greater awareness, but they'll certainly eventually have it, because they will get the real consequences of their behavior. Reincarnation really helps the story, because if not now, later. But if they're allowed to bully and bully and bully and bully and no one ever stands up to them, when will they ever learn that this is not a good idea? It's working really well. So dharma requires, and why am I so afraid to say, but you can have great compassion when you do that. That's, again, why I was able to deal with that man, is I had nothing against him, none at all, zero. I was really impressed. I mean, this man has been a real thorn in my side and the side of Ananda, had been for many years, now he's faded out. But he was just awful and caused us so much trouble, but I just didn't have any personal feeling against him at all. So as a consequence, I could just behave according to dharma. Now, there's another thing that we always say at Ananda, which is where there is dharma. And this is answering Catherine's question about how do you do this. Where there is dharma, there is victory. And this has been a fundamental principle of Ananda from the very beginning. And it's extremely important. Victory doesn't mean that in the moment, in the short term, you will triumph, that everybody will apologize to you, and life will turn into a pleasurable, supportive experience. It doesn't mean that at all. It's victory over delusion for the light. And you may completely bomb out in your incarnation, but in your spirit, if there is dharma, there is victory. So one of the ways that we deal with all of this, And of course, when you talk to me, I have to talk to you the way I live, which is I have a lot of Gemini intuition, calm, clear understanding of things. If I, and one works, one practices when it's easier, is the way I would put it. You know, if you have the idea in your mind, Dharma is that which leads to greater awareness. And at all times, one tries as hard as one can to behave in a dharmic manner, speaking the truth, acting on the truth. Of course, truth is not just fact, and this is appropriate and helpful, which I'll speak about in a minute. And if I behave according to Dharma, it will always come out right in the end. And that means I have to decide what Dharma is. And if I just do it, I have this little thing that I have in my mind. Sometimes it is not obvious how victory is going to result from this dharmic action. Or you can't think of anything that makes any sense that's practical to do, except just some little tiny dharmic action in the midst of it. I call it doing Dharma in a vacuum, which is there's no apparent cause and effect connection between my right action and any positive result. But if I just keep doing the right thing, I know it'll work out. And I mean, sometimes these examples are very hard. Somebody in my life, these things have happened to me. Somebody really wants a certain response from me or really wants me to participate in something, but I know that I can't. They want something from me that I say to myself, I'll put it this way, I always say to people, don't worry, you cannot impose on me. You can ask anything you want of me, because when I can't do it, I will say so. And sometimes I have to disappoint people, and sometimes I have to just behave differently because I know that I can't do it. Just as simple as that. And even if it looks like I must, if I can't, I can't. There you have it. Because where there is Dharma, there is victory. And my welfare, and this took me a long time to learn, is not less important than yours. But if I can help you, even if it costs to myself, if I can, I'm really happy to do it. But if I've reached my limit, I've reached my limit. There it is, you know? Because sacrificing myself is not going to be Dharma if it's not appropriate. Okay, so now we need to get to that word appropriate, which is really the key to all of this. And we need to come back to several other things here. Okay. The word appropriate is just an absolutely marvelous word, because the word appropriate is not the word nice, is not the word selfless, it's not anything, it's just appropriate. You know, given someone's, when that man came in, even though, you know, other people wanted me to extend a magnanimous heart to him, it was not appropriate. Wasn't appropriate for anyone to ask, and it wasn't an appropriate response from my part. And I didn't care if I was making a big scene. When I was working for Swami Kriyananda as his secretary in the, like, 1973 and 74, and I'm a outspoken, slightly volatile type, excitable, and I was at Ananda, and I was in our little master's market, and I don't know what I was upset about, but I was, in a loud voice, I was exclaiming about something. Somebody came up to me and said, it's not appropriate for Swami Kriyananda's secretary to behave as you're behaving, which was not a winning comment for me. And in the same loud, agitated voice, I said, well, I am his secretary, and this is how I'm behaving. You know, the phrase, get over it, wasn't really popular, but it was like, what are you telling me? I'm not going to, of course I know, first, the first thing is you think I don't know it. You know, if I had a choice, do you think I'd be different? I wouldn't be different, of course, but this is what I'm doing. So what are we going to do? And appropriate is also just Dharma. We have to be ourselves. We do not progress by putting on spirituality from the outside. This is one of the biggest mistakes that people make. This is what it looks like to be spiritual. This is how I will behave. That is not appropriate for a really simple reason. It's in the Bhagavad Gita. Of what avail is suppression? That's what Krishna says to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. It will not serve you merely to act from the outside. You have to, spirit, to be a spiritual person is like growing an apple tree from a seed. If you have a seed and you put it in the ground, there are countless stages, and this comes back to time and stages. There are countless stages between the time when that seed is put in the ground and when you're able to pick an apple off that tree. I mean, just think about it. Now you cannot get the apple tree by saying, this is taking too long. You know, it's just like we're just going to skip some of these stages. What we want, since the end point is apples, then we want apples. So we yell at the seed, you know, we withhold water from the seed, we hate the seed, you know, we do all these things. And does it have any effect? Do you get an apple tree 1 second sooner? I mean, what can actually happen is the poor seed will just wither up and die. Now, fortunately, from our soul's evolution point of view, that's not possible. We may lie dormant for as many incarnations as we choose to be drug addicts and crazy people and suicides and bullies. Our potential will lie dormant, but it cannot be killed. So the first thing, and the first thing to deal with all of this is appropriate, and then I'll use another word, we have to be practical. We have to do what works. And in order to be able to do what works, we have to use our discrimination. One of the things that I had to figure out in my life was, and this has really worked for me really well. I'll tell it from the child's point of view. Jyotish and Devi raised a son. And when he was about 7 or 8, I don't know, living in our Ananda community, everybody knows everybody really well. So at the school, our school there, when he was a child in our school there, one of the families in the community was having a hard time in various ways, and their son, I believe, was acting out and was becoming mean in the classroom. You know, these are the things that happen. Children are just people. They have to work it through. So this boy, their son, came home, and he was really angry at this other kid because this other kid had treated him so meanly, and it was just, he was really upset, and he was really blaming the other child and criticizing him. And Jyotish being very wise, Jyotish and Devi being very wise, they just kind of let him do that. But then, you know, at bedtime, when children are more receptive, he's putting him to bed. And Jyotish, this is how the story was told to me. If Jyotish corrects it, I'll let him. But he was just chatting with his son, and he sort of just says a little bit about, you know, when he behaves that way because he's unhappy about other things, it's not really about you, and you could help him if you were kinder and more loving to him. And his son, who was very thoughtful, listened to his dad, and he said, Daddy, I just don't want to be that good. Yeah. And one of my adult friends wrote to Swami Kriyananda about this person who was in the community and he was behaving in a way that she really didn't enjoy, and she wrote this long thing to Swami about how he was behaving and how she didn't like it. Swami wrote back very shortly, he just wants to be your friend. And she wrote back too, that may be true, sir, but I don't want him to be my friend. I don't want to be that good. And so sometimes we just have to be practical. We have to just say, this is only theoretical. The fact of the matter is, I'm just not ready to be that good. I'm going to hold on to my resentments. I want to be angry. It works for me. It seems to work for me. But then we have to then gradually ask ourselves, but appropriate, practical, we have to ask, is this really going to help me? But then we also have to do, when we're practical, we have to work from reality, not theory. I had this experience with Swamiji where he'd given me some very serious spiritual advice and had suggested I follow a certain course of action, which I was simply incapable of following. Just, I couldn't do it. And I didn't want to be hypocritical. So I said, you know, sir, you told me to do this, and I'm just not doing it. And he did not, I don't think he took an extra breath before he said, well, so much for theory, let's deal with reality. You know, it just like, he didn't pause. There wasn't a second in which he offered me what we call true but irrelevant spiritual advice. He just said, well, so much for theory. So to be practical is to deal with reality. You know, maybe Christ-like forgiveness and just letting this go is a good idea, but so what? You know, it just, I remember once I was really distressed about something, and someone came to me and said, "Don't be attached." And I looked at them and I said, "You know, it's like if I wasn't attached, I would never have gotten myself into this situation in the first place." True, but irrelevant. But the trouble is we try to persuade ourselves with true but irrelevant spiritual advice. You have to find out what's real for you. And then you have to be practical and appropriate given what your reality is. And, you know, you have to be able to say self-worth. See, we think self-worth is when I am perfect, then I will be okay. And, I mean, this is a well-documented psychological syndrome where people just frantically try to earn self-acceptance. But self-acceptance, and this is another part of this, is you simply have to, you know, face what is. Let me phrase it differently. And this is critical to everything we're talking about. You have to accept reality. And for devotees, sometimes it's even harder because we have all these theoretical stories about ourselves and the world around us, and they serve to protect us from having to accept reality. There are many realities, such as we are very alone in this world. And even the people who love us the most, you know, I partly put it to the fact that I didn't know for many, many years of my life that other people's mental processes are so different from mine. I have a very, shall I use the word weird? I have a very weird brain. And what is natural to me, I didn't realize this. I'll give you how I really realized this. It was very odd. I'm one of three children. I have an older brother. But my brother and I were never close. He didn't much, my point of view, he didn't much like me. But we just weren't very close. But when I was 50, he lives a very solitary life, but when I was 50, he got himself into kind of, he got a little ill and he couldn't kind of cope with the circumstances of his life, so he actually called my younger sister, with whom he's always been close, but she called me because I'm the practical one. So I ended up involved with him and he came to stay at my house for a few weeks, maybe even longer, which was almost the first time in our lives that we'd ever really connected. I discovered, my gosh, this man is my mental twin. Absolutely. And I mean, still, he's just my mental twin. And it was only when I was actually with someone whose brain process, whose sense of humor, whose perceptions were just exactly like mine. I mean, he's aware on many levels. He's not on this path like my sister is, but nonetheless, his processes were just like, in our humor, unbelievable. We could just glance at each other. We both knew exactly what it was. We didn't even have to speak. And that was when I realized how isolated individuals, how really alone we are in the world. And circumstances separated us again, so it wasn't like this great reunion that has resulted into this soul friendship or anything like that. But it was just given to me by God for me to realize, well, that's why people are always staring at me and wondering, what the hell is she doing? Because it makes so much sense to me, because somebody finally got it. You understand what that means? But there's a profound spiritual lesson there. Because we spend a great deal of our time thinking that other people should understand us. Because we want them to. And we're terrified of the fact that only God's love will never disappoint. You see, that is both comforting and that is terrifying. I've known three or four people in my life who've had complete episodes of breaks, psychotic episodes, whatever the phrase is, psychiatric episodes, where they make a complete break from reality. And in all cases, they were spiritually inclined people who came back from it. But when it happened for the second or third time to someone, I said something to Swami. It said, this seems to me like this is a metaphysical crisis, an existential crisis. And he said, oh, yes. And then he said it very casually. Oh, yes. He said, madness is a stage on the spiritual path. Oh, really? He said, everybody at some point, incarnation or another, gets to the edge of perceiving that in the end, I'm going to have to resolve all these issues myself. Nobody's apology is ever going to be sufficient. And you just say, I think I won't do this now. I think I'll just go over here and just make a self-created subconscious world, and I'll just hang out in it for a while. I believe this has been my primary coping mechanism. I just understand it. I understand how you just say bye-bye to objective reality because it's too much. So don't think that this is simple. In fact, everything I'm saying here, now, the whole concept of forgiveness, which is actually a word I don't like very much. Who is forgiving who? What is this great magnanimous position where I stand here and I say, oh, I forgive you? It's like, who are we to forgive? But what we're really doing is we're trying to accept reality. To forgive someone is just to see it for what it is. You behaved in an abominable way. It must have seemed like a good idea to you at the time. You sacrificed my well-being completely. That was a really scummy thing to do. I'm really upset with you for doing it, and I want you out of my life. I mean, or you say, I understand that, you know, you treated me the way you treated me because you were so mistreated in your life. Compassion and empathy come. And you just like, you're not holding it anymore. But forgiveness implies that I am the magnanimous one, you are the crummy one, and here I am. But to just simply accept reality is we're all God's children. And I think it's a much healthier way to think about it. So when you're talking about forgiving someone, you're just trying to accept reality. That was the mother who raised me. You know, this was the sister who abandoned me. This is the husband who betrayed me or the wife who died. We're just accepting reality. Who we're actually forgiving is we're forgiving God. But even that, we're just accepting reality. Divine Mother knows what she's doing with me. And you can simultaneously be very upset about it. In fact, you get more upset. I do. Because I remember at one point, what I was really angry about was that I knew that I was going to have to expand my consciousness to overcome this. And it just annoyed the heck out of me. I wanted a shortcut. I wanted to be rescued. And to Catherine's question, how do you do this? 99% of the battle is accepting reality, that there is no shortcut, and as I can keep throwing myself against the wall, demanding that it be a door, and no matter how many times I do it, I'm going to have the same result, which is nothing. And that I'm going to suffer. Because how many incarnations of wrong action and wrong thinking got me to this mess? I remember I was at one of my cycles at Ananda Village when I was still living in the little trailer by myself. I don't really know how I did it, but I systematically got myself quite out of tune. This wasn't the time, but I had several exchanges with Swami. Once he came up to me and said, how are you? And I said, I don't know, sir, how am I? And that became sort of a joke between us. He said, well, I'm a little worried about you. I said, me too. I had just gotten myself kerfuffled up and very confused. But this was not that time, but it was another. And I had just gotten myself kerfuffled up and very confused. I'd been systematically isolating myself from people, systematically harboring resentment, systematically making wrong choices, just very quietly, undramatically, inside myself, just systematically doing it until I felt quite separated from my family. And this is my family. It's the only family I really had. I mean, it was my spiritual family. It was very important. but I felt very isolated from them because I had just made a whole series of choices that were not leading to higher awareness. And I was disliking a lot of people and distrusting a lot of people. And I was very distressed when I kind of cognized where I was. And then it occurred to me, it was really, I just got this really clear picture. This is center, and I had systematically walked away from it. And I realized that nobody had done anything to me. It's just that I just made one choice after another, after another, after another, that finally got me so far away from where I wanted to be that I noticed. And you see, that's actually a blessing. Because when I was just here, I hadn't noticed. I had to keep pushing it. Now, bear in mind, this is how it works reincarnationally, too. It's that we often are born into circumstances that make our bad qualities worse. This puzzled me because I thought, why didn't I choose circumstances that would have balanced my bad qualities, my delusions, whatever they were, whatever they are, my delusions that people should take care of me, they should be nice to me, that I need to be humble, that I need to be devotional, or I need to be disciplined, whatever it might be. I looked at my life and I basically made everything worse. I was born into things that took all my faults and made them worse. I thought, why? And I thought, oh, because they got bad enough for me to notice. And I just, because I needed to realize that this is not working. So in this particular small thing, I realized that I'd walked all the way over to here. So I'm sobbing and feeling guilty and feeling really bad about myself and railing against the universe and falling into despair, you know, just all the things that are not at all funny when you're doing them. You know, they're not even slightly amusing. But then it just came to me, sort of like this, honey, you walked over here, just turn around and walk back. Oh. So very shortly after that, I was actually in town. When you live in an Ananda Village, town is this concept because it's really rural and you have to drive 20 miles to get to town and, you know, and then you can shop and do things, otherwise you're way out in the country. So I was in town and I was in the grocery store there, and there were these two people that I really didn't like very much, you know, among the many people I didn't like, these were two of them. And you know how it is in a grocery aisle, you sort of walk by and you see someone, you don't want to talk to them, you pretend you haven't seen them, you just like act as if I didn't notice you there. So I saw them and then I pretended I didn't see them and started walking in the same direction. But then it crossed my mind, this is exactly what got me into trouble, which was I'm indulging all my little likes and dislikes and I'm thinking bad of people. So I turned around and I went down to the aisle and I just started walking back. And I walked up to them and I started a conversation. You know, I'm facile that way, so it wasn't hard. We actually had a lovely conversation, and eventually they separated themselves from Ananda, but we actually were really good friends after that. Just because I decided that we would be. But also, and this is what's fascinating about Dharma. It's like Dharma is going with the current. So when you start behaving properly, you suddenly have the wind under your wings. So just that decision, it was so small. I just went and had a pleasant conversation with people I didn't like. And then all of a sudden, I was walking back. Now, sometimes the distance is really far. And when that's the case, see, this is where we always want a shortcut. We want to be rescued. I have this tremendous antagonism towards so-and-so, and you want it to be solved. And sometimes you keep throwing yourself into the lion's ring, and then you get eaten alive, and then you get bloodied, and you crawl out. You have to practice where it's easier, and you have to realize that the huge mountain is created by 1,000 tiny pebbles. And that whatever your big story is, it also has lots of little parts. So you know, people come home and they're angry at the clerk in the store because they didn't behave properly, and they're angry at the person who cut them off when they were driving, and they're angry at the barista for mixing up your order, and all these different things. And you don't understand that that's why you hate your mother, is because you have a habit of responding to life that way. So we dug the hole ourselves really deep, and we're going to have to walk it back all the way. And we're going to have to understand and this is important, to accept reality is a matter of life and death. And when we're tired of suffering, we'll change. When the effort to shift our consciousness looks less terrible to us than to continue as we are, that is the point at which we will shift. And as long as it's working and we feel like we're suffering less by continuing as we are than we would suffer if we tried to change, we will continue as we are. And you also have to accept reality. And I mean, I had to really accept. I enjoy being angry. And it was a hard one to accept. I enjoy being really mad at these people and waiting for them to apologize. I like to run this self-justifying tape. And I enjoy running over all the wrongs that were done to me. And I had to admit that I did. It was kind of like whenever I wanted to be cozy, I would just fall back into the list of everything, everyone who'd done me wrong. It made me feel comforted. And it was not a happy thought, but it was the truth. So that was the beginning, because then you know what battles to fight. Otherwise, you're not even fighting the right battle. You're trying to give yourself constant, irrelevant spiritual advice instead of feeling, you know, I'm a nasty, angry person, and I need to really start working with this. And, you know, I couldn't attack the big one, so I started attacking all the little ones. Every time that same syndrome would manifest itself in a circumstance where I had the willpower to overcome it, I started trying to dismantle the habitual response. And there is no shortcut. Your hole is exactly as deep as the number of spades you have put into the ground and dug. And if you don't, I mean, this is what I say to myself now. Whoa, this karma is no fun now. I really don't want to see it again. And that motivates me. You know, sufficient unto the day, I don't want it to be my tomorrow. And that'll move me to resist. Okay, comments, thoughts, questions?
Catherine?
Well, I started this at the beginning of the session by saying one of the things I wanted to do was to learn to forgive myself.
Right.
I think that you answered that.
Oh, I'm glad.
Reincarnation.
Yeah. To my mind, you see, none of this works without reincarnation. I just can't. There are a few fundamental things. You have to realize we've been at this longer, and that we, just what I was saying, you push it to the point where you really notice. And I don't want to see this anymore. Yeah. But I think that's fun. Yes, Neha. Uh-huh. Ah, yes, there you have it. We are our stories we've been telling ourselves. Yes, and, you know, someone said to me once, a woman friend, did a very casual remark, and it's actually rather trendy, but I didn't know it at the time. I was explaining to her some confusion I was in, and she said, well, how is that working for you? You know, like, what are you getting from that? And it was like, oh, my gosh. And I really started thinking, you know, of all the things that I avoided having to face, because as long as I was preoccupied with this story, I got to just not have to deal with that. And actually, that story, particular story, was working really, really well for me, because I had a lot of things I just was too afraid to deal with, so I would be preoccupied over here. Swamiji used to try to say that to me, and I didn't get it. He said, guilt is not the same as repentance. And he said, I would feel that I was so engaged in trying to be better because I was suffering so much. And he would suggest to me that I direct some of that energy to actually doing something constructive, but I couldn't even comprehend what he was telling me, because the guilt prevented me from having to see myself as I really was. Because, okay, let me say this, humility is self-honesty. And when we're not ready to be self-honest, we often make ourselves much worse, because then we still get to avoid having to actually accept reality. The way I've expressed it to other people and to myself, is most of us are just pretty unremarkably mediocre. And that is really hard to handle. So since we have failed at being the best, we will at least be the worst. Because the fact that we're just a mediocre middle whose lives really are quite insignificant and won't make any difference to anyone, it's really grim. So we do this exaggerated self-blame instead, because we're just a mixture, really. And that's a very serious thing to contemplate. I'm just nothing in particular. You know, I'm pretty nice, and then I have some lousy qualities. But it's the only practical response, because accepting reality is the beginning of spiritual life. And I've watched, you know, I've been on this path now, it's almost 50 years. That's a really long time. In terms of being, it doesn't feel like long in terms of my actual feeling about the time, but it's brought in front of me hundreds, thousands of people whose lives I've watched for a sufficient number of years to really see the pattern. Anybody who tries to run their life, their spiritual life, by theory, on the path of self-realization inspired by Master and Swami Kriyananda, eventually the gap, it's like God pulls the rug out from under you. You crash to the ground to whatever is real. And then you either repudiate the spiritual path at that point, or you start building it up for real. Because there's no way that you can skip those middle stages. And at the beginning, one thinks, oh, I can't let anybody know. I have to pretend. I look at everybody else. But after a while, you realize, I am Swami Kriyananda's secretary, and I'm behaving this way. I guess this is what his secretary does. You know, because you have to go through every stage that there is. And then you suddenly realize that that's really what everybody else is doing or will be forced to eventually. But then you have to accept reality that I'm not always nice. I don't always like the spiritual path. I remember, a couple of things happened. Once, when Ananda Village was really small, when there were 50 or 60 or 100 people living there, Swami Kriyananda was the only one who gave Kriya initiation, which was a huge, big event. And also, we all lived together on this piece of land. Most of us had no money. Most of us had no automobiles. So we couldn't go anywhere else. And most people had nowhere else to go. So when things happened, if you weren't there, everyone noticed. Especially Swami gave Kriya initiation. And if you weren't there, everyone knew. So this one man didn't come. And the next morning, Swami asked me, would you please go find out why he didn't come? So I went and I said, Swami noticed your absence. He said, very frankly, because he lived by reality, does still. He's a very frank person and he doesn't live by theory. He said, I just didn't feel like bowing down to the gurus or anyone else last night. So I went and I told Swami, and Swami said, I can understand that. I mean, that's just about how much he said. Oh, I understand that. He said, we all feel that way sometime. You know, that's really what it is. And I'll just tell you one more. This other man who lived at Ananda for years, I guess he had an inclination from time to time to drink. He just came crashing into Swami's house once, just as drunk as a sailor, just totally drunk, very cheerful, but just absolutely smashed. Swami entertained him for a period of time and then sent him home. You know, and afterwards Swami just said, well, you know, these things happen. Because it's not a straight line. And this is where stages of, it's not either or. We're all trying to get to a certain goal that is incredibly difficult to achieve. And progress is not a straight line. All that we have to do is not give up. And the fact that we fall, so what? Did you raise your hand? No, it was Joy.
Yeah, I just had a seed kind of thought about arrogance and self-involvement. And what it came to me as is we're so self-involved that seems to me like our forgiveness is the opposite side of the point of judgment.
Yeah.
Judgment on one side and forgiveness on the other. That includes forgiving ourselves and judging ourselves.
All
the,
yeah.
And so the, I can't even quite formulate the question that even forgiveness is, it involves some kind of transcendence of both of these things.
Well, that's why I prefer the phrase accept reality. Because then there's no ego involved on either side. When you forgive, there's a person who's done wrong, and then there's you who's magnanimous. And of course, we have to use language. It's a meaningful concept. And if you've been blaming someone and then you forgive them, that's a level of empathy and compassion and understanding. It's not completely false. But I think accepting reality goes farther in terms of liberating us. Because you're accepting their limitations, you're accepting my limitations, you're accepting God's will in the whole thing, you're realizing that I'll never progress unless I deal with what is. I'm tired of theory, I just want to deal with reality. It's very, very neutral. It's an everybody gets to win, and it's also much easier to figure out what's appropriate if you accept reality. If you merely forgive, then you have been wronged, but now you're magnanimous enough not to be. But, you know, what will happen the next time? Will you then blame again? But if you get in the habit of accepting reality, like when I said to Swamiji, well, so much for theory, let's just deal with reality. I mean, one of the reasons that Ananda has succeeded is because we're very, very practical. And Swamiji has never expected of us more than we could deliver. He's never set for us this absolute standard. He's realized, and I'll go to the word, that it's all directional. That it, wherever you're standing, progress for you, if you're an apple seed, you know, and you're still underground just trying to put out a few roots, to imagine that what you're supposed to do is put up a stick and start making leaves, it's just not appropriate. Because you're still an apple seed trying to get your first little shoots out. So we have to deal with, well, you're an apple seed. Let's work on getting your roots out. Instead of saying you're an apple tree, where's the fruit? And when we're judging ourselves, especially unreasonable, harsh judgment, well, any judgment at all, it's just a fact. It's like, so I screwed up. It's like, yeah, that's what I did. So would I have done it if I'd had a choice? Wouldn't I be producing apples if I wasn't still a seed underground? Sure, I'd love to produce apples, but what is the point of even thinking about apples? I've got to concentrate here. And what happens to people is, this is very complicated because you need to see that there's a high mountain there. I was talking to one man about this. He kept telling me about his enormous vision. I kept saying, why don't you put your eyes on your feet? Because he was looking there, but he wasn't looking at his feet, which means he didn't know where to put his foot next because he was so looking at that. Do you understand? It's like, you know, if you're a nasty, angry person, you have to stop yelling at the other drivers. It really isn't a matter of forgiving the person who stole your inheritance. You really have to look at your feet and say, well, this is what I can actually do. That one's just going to have to wait. And that's accepting reality, which is very ego-crushing as a rule. Yeah, because we're just, here we are. But then you get kind of childlike about it. There was this little boy, there was this, when we had this ashram house in San Francisco, there was a family there, and there was a little boy about, I don't know how old he would be, 2 or 3, whatever stage it is where they're kind of like this, like they're feeding themselves, but they're like this. Pretty much every dinner he knocked over his milk glass, you know, and it just would pour across the table. And his father got really impatient with him one day, and the little boy looked up and said, Daddy, when I was the daddy and you were the little boy, I never yelled at you. Oops. But that, you know, it's like, I'm the little child. Why am I yelling at myself? I don't have mastery. But I will. But yelling at me is not going to give me mastery. You know, self-forgiveness is to realize that I am not more or less important than anyone else. I developed the capacity to accept myself because I have and I used one particular friend, but I have this girlfriend who's a bit feisty and is not everybody's cup of tea, but she's mine, my cup of tea. And for some reason, I don't know, whatever she did would just amuse me. It never upset me. And I have absolute faith in her spiritual sincerity, and I just know that she's a child of God, and no matter what it is, she's going to work it out. So it just, I'm gifted in her case with this marvelous acceptance and love. One day I realized that I never treated myself the way I treated her. And every little mistake I made, I always thought was cosmic, where she could do things that were much worse. And it wasn't an affectation. I just knew that it would be okay. It was just a blip on the horizon. And I thought, I had to think to myself, really, I'm not worse than her. I'm not less sincere than her. But when she does it, I think it's fine. When I do it, I elevated it to, you know, as big as the cosmos. And so I actually, literally, started pretending that I was her. And when something weird would happen to me, which happened on a fairly steady, pretty speedy basis, I would pretend that my girlfriend had done it and she had brought it to me. And then I would answer as if she had done it. And my goodness, my answers to her were different than my answers to me. Now that's a clue. That was a stunning realization. Because it was the beginning of what? True humility, actually. Just true self-honesty. Quit pretending you're just so special that you're the worst. You're really just so ordinary. Just so ordinary. It's not even worth commenting. Now, are these things a shortcut? No. Because there is no shortcut. Are these the right road that will eventually take you out of the woods? Yes. But just as it was pleasurable to sink into these wrong attitudes, you have to work your way out of them. We're at the bottom of a deep well, and the slides are pretty slick, and we have to just keep, you know, like a climbing wall. I would like to take another short break, and then we'll come back for the last bit. So if there's anything left that hasn't been covered, we might talk about time when you come back, but let's just take a breather. My concern, which is really as much paranoia as wisdom, is that I outlast things rather than transcend them, and the next time they hit me, they're going to hit me just as hard. I mean, that's a fear. I'm glad I'm not being, I guess I am being recorded, but I would rather not be recorded because I don't really, it's just something that I've wondered about. Because I know if you outlast it, you'll also, the pain, assuming it's pain or heartbreak, will diminish. But if the same thing happens to me again, will I have to repeat the same cycle? You know, and I know there is such a thing as transcendence in which if the same thing happens, I will respond differently, because we've all had those experiences where we know that we have actually changed. So it's just more like a pondering. You know, I asked Swamiji the question. I said, you know, I feel so much calmer and wiser than I did when I was younger. But my fear is that when I reincarnate and I'm young again, I'll be just as stupid as I was. That I haven't really gotten wiser, I've just gotten tired. He didn't answer me. It was when he said to me, reincarnation is caused by longing and regret. Which was sort of an answer, but not really. I just wanted him to assure me that I had actually learned something. Since then, I have felt that I have actually learned something, but, you know, that was my fear. Yes.
Reality does change.
Reality does change. Meaning what?
What's real today? Not reality, but just what is in life.
Yes. Tomorrow is different. So if I go back to what was, will I be the same person, or am I different now? No, this is a late night coffee-fueled midnight discussion. You know, it's not a... Pardon me? Were you going to say Vajina?
No, but I guess I was still thinking of the reality. I was listening to you, but I don't like to accept reality sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I have hope that what is real, like if someone is horrible or seemed horrible and hurt me, and that tomorrow they won't be.
Why don't you just start up again? No. What's just been raised is an extremely important point, which is, if we're saying we're accepting reality, does that mean we're giving up hope that reality can be changed? But that's, let me just stop and think about that, because I understand what you're asking. No, in fact, to accept reality on the highest level is the only basis for hope, because the highest level of reality is that we are all children of God, and we will all ultimately discover our true nature and become bliss and become perfect instruments of the divine. And that is the actual only basis for hope. To hope that somebody will expand their awareness and change their consciousness according to our timetable is wishful thinking. And it may prove to be true, it may not, but we're more likely to be able to be helpful to them, which is what I didn't put on the board, to be actually helpful to others, if we have deep faith in their divine potential, not merely a commitment to their behaving in a way that eases our fear and pleases us. You know, wishful thinking versus positive thinking, that's the line. Positive thinking is based on a real acceptance of reality, which is sooner or later everyone's going to get it right. Wishful thinking is that they will get it right according to my timetable and my personal needs. And as long as we're working according to my personal needs and my timetable, we are trying to impose on reality our preferences. Now, that doesn't mean you can't say... I learned this very strongly in the last 10 years of my parents' life. My mother had Parkinson's, and in the last few years, my father's mind was not normal. And it was tough for me. They lived in Los Angeles, but I ended up having to be one of their primary, pretty much their primary life managers. And I really wanted it to be different. And for a while... Because I have no fear of people dying, I feel comfortable with the fact that people are going to die sooner or later. My actual thought was to Master was, why don't you just take them out of those bodies? Those bodies are not serving them well. Don't you think it's time for an astral vacation? That was sort of... But after a while, I realized that the reason I wanted them to be out of their bodies was, yes, because I felt that their quality of life from my point of view, was not what it could be, but really because it would be much more convenient for me if they just left their bodies, because I wasn't afraid of them dying and I didn't need them to stay in their bodies. It would be more convenient for me if they weren't in them. And I thought that that was an appropriate prayer until I realized that it was wishful thinking on my part for my convenience. And I just thought, that's not an appropriate prayer, that I should be trying to run their lives according to my convenience. And it was within my power to take care of them. They had sufficient money and I had sufficient freedom to be able to do it. So it wasn't really even a crisis. So then I changed my prayer to, Lord, this is not a lot of fun. This is really super not fun for me. And it doesn't look like a lot of fun for them. So whatever it is you're trying to teach them, I said, you need to give them the wisdom, the receptivity, and the humility to learn it, and I would really appreciate it if that happened soon. And it was a very honest prayer, because I was really not having any fun. But I took that energy, and I made it to accept reality. This is their karma. And I thought to myself, if they could make a lot of spiritual progress, if they could work out a lot of karma, if they could grow from this seemingly unpleasant experience, why would I not want them to have that experience? Even more, if this is the only way they can grow, why would I want them not to have that experience? Because it's inconvenient and painful for me. Whoa, that doesn't really sound very good. But I didn't pretend that I was contented with circumstances as they were. It was the Jesus prayer, the most important Jesus prayer there is. Lord, let this cup pass from me. Jesus actually said, I would like it to be different. He was about to be crucified, and it wasn't because he was going to be crucified. It was because these people had rejected what he brought them. He came to bring them this wonderful message of freedom, and they had rejected it. And he knew that was a really unfortunate thing that they were doing. So he said, you know, let this not happen. This is like not good. But then after he prayed that, he said, but thy will, not mine, be done. So I've always took that to mean you can say whatever you want to say. And you can be as strong and as determined and as annoyed and as angry as you want to be. And then afterwards you say, but what do I know? You know what's supposed to happen here. And that became my prayer for my parents. And it really worked. I think it really helped them. God knows it helped me. But it also taught me, I had to just really keep saying, why would I not want them to learn? So when you're looking at someone, you're not really saying, I want you to be different. I mean, you might be saying that, but what you really want is you want them to be free. And if the only way they're going to be free is to go through this horrible experience, but if at the end of it they will have learned something they absolutely must learn, why would you try to prevent that from happening? Because it hurts me. So is that like, where is the selfless service in this? But you can say, I mean, and I, on one other occasion, I basically, I was in a very difficult situation that I could not influence with a lot of people suffering, and I really wanted it to be different. And then I say this awful thing happened. This awful thing happened when this thought came into my mind that said, could this be happening outside the will of God? And I was really annoyed because I had to say, no, of course it's not. This has to be God's will. And so I had to accept that this was reality. This was what God wanted. But then I said, well, you know what? I'm about at the end of my tether. And if you don't really get these people through this pretty soon, you know, we're going to have another casualty and that's going to be me. And then 5 minutes later, the situation shifted. But it was just like, okay, they can all exist simultaneously. See, this is where, and this was the stage, directional rather than absolute. Our direction can be complete acceptance of God's will, but our reality can be quite a mixed bag, you know, with a lot of ups and downs in it. And part of how we progress on the spiritual path is we have to accept the reality. I'm very sincere, and today I'm going to be naughty. I remember once I was faced with some serious temptations of an emotional type. And I remember saying to God in my meditation in the morning, if you push me, I will respond incorrectly. I don't have a chance of resisting this negative inclination of mine. So the only choice here is that you have to keep me from having the chance to fall. And when I would pray that really sincerely, I would be protected all day. And if I didn't, you know, then I would just tumble down the rabbit hole. But that is what it is. And if you don't quit, there's no shortcut. But if you don't quit, what do you know? You'll look back and you'll think, whoa, I've come a long distance. And you don't even really know how you did. You just kept at it. But once you stop waiting to be rescued, once you stop thinking there's got to be an easier way, there's a shortcut here that people aren't telling me about, you know, a huge amount of energy is liberated because all those delusions take a tremendous amount of energy to sustain. And when you don't, what Swami called it, our shortcomings are bad enough. We don't need to create a complex about having them. Because the complex is much harder to work with because it's not connected to anything. The shortcomings are just a fact. Well, you know, I'm short-tempered, and when you treat me like that, I am really rude to you, and that's the way it is. You know, someday it'll be different, but this is what... Yeah, you know, I really like to drink, take drugs, go out at night, be unfaithful to my spouse. I like it. I want to do it. You know, it's not good, but this is who I am, and sooner or later I'm going to straighten it out. I'm not proud of it. I'm not... But it's just what I am. I have to accept reality and work with it rather than hate it. When you divide yourself up between what you aspire to be and what you actually are, you spend so much energy fighting against what is. And sometimes you just have to say, well, I'm a nasty, small-minded person in this respect. And these people have mistreated me in too many incarnations, and I don't like them. Once I was embroiled with people, you know, my brothers and sisters at Ananda, and something happened. I made a phone call. Swami asked me to make a phone call. I called these people. He was right in the room with me. I called them, and they treated me very badly. And afterwards, I was really annoyed. And I said, you know, blah, 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 they never respect me, blah, 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 like this. And Swami said, how did he phrase it? Do you ever speak against them? He said. I said, all the time. And then he just kind of smiled, and I smiled, and I thought, well, what did I expect? I'm constantly putting out negative energy, so surprise, surprise, it comes back at me. And, you know, but that was a big moment, because I just said, yeah, I do. I'm nasty. It was one of the first times in my life I was able just to look him right in the eye and say, yeah, I'm really nasty. And he just shrugged his shoulders, like, yeah, of course you are. So when other people come to me and just, you know, say, well, you know, I'm really crummy in this way, I say, yeah. Like, so what? And? That's exactly right. You have to accept reality. If you are a little seed underground trying to make your first sprout, you cannot be upset because you haven't made apples. Like, you know, you can just scream at that seed as much as you want, and there is nothing it can do except try to work on those little roots. And you see how ridiculous it is when you praise it like that? But that's precisely what we do to ourselves. And we think it's God's will. We think we're following the path. We're out of our minds. You know, this is a very important point, and unfortunately I have to refer to SRF in order to make this point clear, but it's very important. Swamiji was very displeased with the way SRF, Self-Realization Fellowship, edits Master's words. He said, it doesn't sound like Master. That's what he said for years. And now, I'm not going to be universal about this. I'm going to kind of speak to the internet audience, so please don't send me emails with examples that are exceptions. I'm making I'm describing the essence of something rather than every detail that is accurate. But what would happen is that they tend to edit Master's words. They tend to edit Master's words in absolutes. You know, so you have a whole series of declarative sentences. You know, love God, surrender to God, overcome the ego, meditate more deeply today than you meditated yesterday. You know, trust God. It tends to be a whole series of declarative sentences. So then you end up, and if you're not a wordsmith, you don't actually even notice. You just realize that you're getting a lot of commands to be different. Whereas if you read the way Swami edits Master, Essence of Self-Realization, The Path, Conversations with Yogananda, he converses with you. You know, you will find if you try this. And it's not that he never makes declarative sentences, but when somebody just simply tells you to be different, you tend to feel discouraged rather than encouraged. And so when we internalize that, either because of whatever, It's a very subtle and serious problem. And Swami said once, you can always tell the difference between whether you're being inspired by God or deluded by Satan. The Master, he spoke of Master, he said, God always makes you feel encouraged, Satan makes you feel discouraged. And if you're feeling discouraged by what you're thinking, you're being influenced by Satan, you're not being inspired by God. You know, you just get a few simple templates like that, begins to make you suspicious of your own mind. Discrimination, that's what you're developing. Joy?
Well, I was just thinking about SRF writing as opposed to, yeah, Swami's editing, is that Swami kind of leaves you space. To come to your own realization.
Mm-hmm. And
as opposed to issuing an edict.
Right. So I'm not going to extrapolate too far from it. I'm just going to say that the editing is different. And if we start talking to ourselves in declarative sentences, we need to be careful. You know, and of course, every so often, an exhortation to greatness is worth it, and we ought to hear it. We ought not to be afraid of it. But if one is only talking to oneself in declarative sentences, you have to realize that I'm off. Something is off here. Right? All right. I wanted to say something about time, if there's nothing else, but first I want to hear if there's anything else, because we're running out of it. And I want to do something that I think is fun. When we put out the movie Finding Happiness, Shivani, who was the executive producer, had this idea that we would do all these follow-up seminars on the movie Happiness. So I had to do a few seminars on what it is to find happiness, and she was hoping for a template, but unfortunately my template was really very useless because it was too idiosyncratic to my way of thinking. This is, you know, my brother and I have the same mind, but not everyone does. But one of the things I realized about happiness had to do with time. So let me think about this. So if we think of past, present, and future, you know, sort of in this sequence like this, and we think of the eternal now being in the center. When Swami Kriyananda was a child, he said he would fall asleep he would see a light would appear. This is just from childhood, maybe even from when he was a baby. He would lie down to sleep, this great light would appear, he would gaze into the light, and eventually he would merge into the light. And he thought that's what happened to everyone when they went to sleep. You know, he was, at the age of 9, he had a very serious illness and had a lot of delirium. And after the delirium, he said he became suspicious of any altered state of consciousness. And simultaneously, about the age of 9, he began to realize that the world he inhabited was not shared by anyone else. He said, actually, until he read Autobiography of a Yogi, and then he said he realized that Master lived in the same world he lived in, which is a beautiful way to put it, which is one of the reasons he just gave up everything and went to be with Master. But he realized that especially his father did not share his world, and after the age of 9, he wanted to be more normal, which lasted until he met Master when he was 22. And then after, he says this in another place, after he learned Kriya and started meditating, he went back into the superconscious state that he had often experienced as a child, and when he went back into it, he realized that no time had passed, that in superconsciousness it was always the same now. Isn't that, I mean, the whole thing is so fascinating to me, which led to this idea that this is superconsciousness and it's in the center. And because we tend to think in past, present, and future, we have our little incarnations. So we take our superconscious self and we reduce ourselves to this little incarnation. And when you're here on this line, you may be able to see back a little bit, you may be able to see a little bit, depending on how completely defined you are in who you are right now, how small you've made yourself as a little dot, is how much of the past or the future you understand or remember. Now, I'll give a very silly example, but when we first took over this apartment complex where our community is now, 1989, it was fully occupied by other people, and it was a very rather run-down place, and many people in there were not very aware, let's just use that word. And so first I was living in a one-bedroom apartment that was in what is called Building 1, what we call Building 1, and there's a driveway right behind it. And one Saturday morning at 6:30 in the morning, one of my neighbors parked his car right outside where all of our bedrooms were, turned on his radio really loud, and started working on his engine. And you know, just bah, like this. I mean, the train is impersonal, but here's this guy who's just turning on this. And I think to myself, does he have no idea of you know, how completely unconscious this behavior is. And of course I thought, no, he has no idea. But then what's going to happen to him is that other people are going to disregard his reality, and he's going to feel very angry about that. Because he's so identified with himself and his own interests that he has no conception of past or future. You know, the cause and effect relationship of his own actions is completely lost to him. So he doesn't even think to modify his actions because he doesn't even know, because he's so, you don't say in the now, he's just so identified with what's going on that he can't see it. Now, what happens to us when we get on the spiritual path is to at least to some extent, we begin to, I understand, you know, I mean, we just begin to think, I'm a person, even without reincarnation. You know, I am a person, if I finish my college degree, I'll be able to get a better job, even though I'm not enjoying it, I'll do it now. If I continually am mean to the people in my life, then they're going to be mean to me. We just begin to get, we get a little bigger than the tiniest self-interest. And as soon as we're a little bigger, we can see a little bit into the past, and we can also see a little bit into the future. So our sense, our relationship to time begins to shift. Now what happens here is as we get bigger and bigger, we move closer and closer to the center point of superconsciousness. So from the center point of superconsciousness, past, future, present, they're all equidistant, aren't they? Because identified at this point, we just see it all as a flow of energy. This is where the Bhrigu sage can make predictions for thousands of years in the future because he's standing as close to any point in time. So we begin to expand our awareness, and time itself becomes less of a confinement for us. So at its best, I'll use as a very small example that Swami himself often used. At one point many years ago, he was going on a skiing trip. He developed terrible arthritis in his hips, but as a child in Europe, he skied all the time and he loved to ski. Even up into the time that I knew him, into the 70s, he was still skiing. But he was going on a skiing trip and he was driving this car, and he was driving. And he thought the tires had been changed, new tires, but in fact they hadn't been, and he was driving on bald tires. And they were going to ski, so it was snowy. And it started snowing, and he hit the brakes, and the car just, you know, did what it does, and it smashed into the side of a Greyhound bus. Fortunately, they weren't going very fast. The car was completely smashed up, but the people just got out, and he always said later, if you're going to smash into something, a bus is very convenient, especially a bus that's going where you were going. So they just abandoned the car, picked up, I wasn't in on that trip, but they all took their luggage, they got on the bus, and they went and had their ski vacation. And he was perfectly cheerful, even though his car was completely totaled over here. And people on the bus were like, you know, they were so commiserated, and they found it so remarkable that he was so cheerful. His response was really simple. He said, a few days from now, it won't matter. Why waste all that time? So ideally, what happens to us the closer we get to superconsciousness, somebody betrays us, something really hurtful happens, we become really disappointed. We know that eventually this is not going to be an issue. So the closer we are to superconsciousness, the more we're dealing with expanded reality. It doesn't change what happens. And it doesn't cause us to say, oh, I'm so glad my car was smashed up. I'm so glad my child died. I'm so glad that, you know, I lost my job. I'm so glad that my inheritance was stolen. It doesn't change what happens to us, but it allows us to see it in a greater cycle. So there's two ways that time eases our suffering. One is that it moves into the background, as Swami put it, and it becomes blurred by more immediate concerns. So it's not really that our relationship to it has changed, it's just that we're not as conscious of it anymore, which means that the next time it happens, it's going to hit us the same way. The other way that time heals us is that we gradually get perspective. We get perspective, and other events happen, or the positive benefits of it unfold in front of us. We begin to remember other traumas from the past that in the end worked out well. we get deeper philosophically and recognize that everything happens for the best. In other words, in one way or another, we move closer to superconsciousness. And then in that case, time is our friend. So if we use time merely to dull our perceptions, then we're just setting ourselves up again. I'll put it this way. Swamiji says, his phrase is, you know, when a karmic wave hits you, there's a moment of maximum intensity. You know, when you get the news that the accident has happened, when you get the cancer diagnosis, when you're the person you hoped would love you tells you definitively that it's never going to happen. There's a point of maximum intensity like that. And so what happens is a karmic wave, we're this big, our consciousness is this big, and the karmic wave is this big, and so it eats us. It just like what happens to you in the ocean. You get driven onto the sand, and you're just smashed by it like that, and you're tumbled around, you don't know what to do. Most of the time, the karmic wave is too big, it smashes us, but what happens is, over time, the power of that wave gradually diminishes. So if we wait long enough, usually, time itself will diminish the wave, and then we'll say, I'm over it. But what we're over is the diminished wave, and if that wave goes that big again, we will have exactly the same experience. So what we try to do and need to do, and Swami said, is try to meet it at the crest. Because if you can meet it at the crest, or even try to meet it at the crest, then you've expanded your consciousness, and whatever success you have will because you have gotten bigger, not merely because it has gotten smaller. Now, this is by no means easy at all, but it's an incentive to try. And in other words, you know, just an incentive always, no matter how long you're lying on the ground having a tantrum, no matter how much you're screaming, no matter how much you're crying, no matter how much you're drinking or whatever you're doing, when you get a little bit of yourself back, you say, but thy will, not mine, be done. And that's all that's required. Because you see, that's 100% victory. Because no matter how much you're being tumbled about, you still know which way you're going. Accepting reality. Have you called that forgiveness of self and others, whatever you want to. Okay? Does that make sense? So, anything else before we call it the end of the day? All right, going, going, gone. Thank you very much.